Welcome to Saving Seafood Radio. Joining us today from Miami, Florida, is Dr. Victor Restrepo. Dr. Restrepo is the Senior Vice President for Science at the International Seafood Sustainability Foundation. He previously served as the head scientist at the International Commission for the Conservation of Atlantic Tuna, better known as ICAT. Dr. Restrepo, thank you very much for interrupting your vacation and being with us today.
Good morning. It's a pleasure to be with you.
I was very much taken by a blog post that you put up about a month ago, back in July. You presided over the defense of a Ph. dissertation of a bright young student, I guess now a Ph.D., Maria Jose Juan Horda in Spain, and very interesting dissertation. She looked at an argument, about a hypothesis that was put out in a somewhat famous paper, Myers and Worm from 2003, that suggested that 90% of the large oceanic predators, mostly tunas, had declined. And what Dr. Juan Horda has determined is that that is not exactly true. Now, there have been a number of issues raised with that paper, but could you tell us a little bit about her research and what she found as it relates to Atlantic tunas?
Yes. What Maria Jose did was a very nice, thorough job. She didn't really say anything new, but she came out with a very thorough dissertation where she proved the many rebuttals of that paper that was published 10 years ago. And basically, she collected all of the stock assessment results for 26 populations of tuna and tuna-like species, like mackerels, throughout the world. And she analyzed the annual rates of decline, and she looked at the causes for the declines. In some cases, there were no declines in the populations. And she came up with a much more thorough analysis of all of these tuna and tuna-like populations worldwide. And her results show that overall, the decline has not been 90%, like in that paper published in Nature in 2003. Instead of 90%, the figure is more like 50%. Of course, some stocks have declined more, some stocks have declined less. Notably, the bluefin tuna populations have seen large declines over the last 40 years or so. But other species, like the tropical tunas, have not declined nearly as much. So basically, she came up with a very comprehensive analysis that is yet another rebuttal of that paper published in Nature in 2003.
Doctor, when the paper was originally published and when these numbers are tossed about, they talk about the decline from pre-industrial levels. Since those levels weren't measured, back in the 1400s, 1500s, when cod was being fished up in the north, and there were folks were sailing from Europe and fishing. Since we don't actually have scientific surveys, how do we determine what the theoretical pre-industrial level is?
Yeah, that's a very good question. Essentially, it's an extrapolation that comes out of the models that are computer models or statistical models that are run to estimate what's the current level of the population. And this current level is always compared to some estimate of what the unfished level was. In most cases, in tuna populations, the unfished level is assumed to start at about 1950. So basically, you look at the rate of decline in catch rates, in the catch per number of boats or catch per number of days fished. And you see how that changes over time. And you extrapolate to some hypothetical value that is assumed to be what is called sometimes the virgin level of the population or the unfished level. In that publication, it was called the pre-industrial fisheries level.
So the pre-industrial fisheries level is really 1950, not really pre-industrial, I guess.
Right. It means pre-industrial from the point of view of commercial tuna fisheries, which really started in the 1950s in terms of large industrial fisheries. Of course, there has always been fishing for tunas for much longer, but not at the levels that occurred after, let's say, 1955.
Okay,
so
not pre-industrial revolution, but pre-industrialization of the fishing fleets.
Yes, of the tuna fishing fleets. Correct.
You mentioned also in the post that a number of environmental groups immediately embraced the Myers and Worm paper as proof that all tunas, not just bluefins, were in trouble, but that tuna scientists who were actually out there conducting stock assessments especially for the tropical tunas, immediately responded to the paper with the reaction that the 90% number had to be wrong. Why was it so obviously wrong to those scientists and yet something that two well-regarded scientists published? Any thoughts on that?
Yes, well, these two well-regarded scientists, actually one of them, who unfortunately passed away, was actually a very good friend of mine. They were very bright scientists, very good scientists, but they were not familiar with tuna fisheries, which are quite complex because you have fisheries that take large fish, fisheries that target small fish, different areas of the ocean. They're quite different from, let's say, the typical cod fishery that the scientists looked at before. So they were not really familiar with all of the data that are necessary to assess a tuna stock. While on the other hand, the scientists that conduct tuna stock assessments regularly, they knew that if you ignore certain pieces of information in a stock assessment, you obtain a biased result. And that's basically that publication was a biased look at what the populations of tunas were doing. So the reaction amongst all tuna scientists that I knew when the paper was published was, of course, this cannot be right because, you know, looking at all of the data from all of the fisheries, and these are not the estimates that we're obtaining. It's not a 90% decline since the 1950s. It's more like a 50% decline.
And that was because if I understand correctly, the fundamental flaw was that they extrapolated their numbers and their argument from one particular type of fishing gear?
That's correct. They were looking mostly at catch rates, that's catch per number of hooks, in longline fisheries. And the longline fisheries only target a segment of the population, particularly the very large fish. So there were very large declines in the catch rates of very large tuna, especially when the commercial tuna fisheries started, when the industrial fisheries started. And that's normal. That rapid rate of depletion is normal, but that depletion does not reflect the depletion in the total population, only in a segment of the population.
We are speaking with Dr. Victor Restrepo, the Senior Vice President for Science at the International Seafood Sustainability Foundation, formerly the head scientist at ICAT in Madrid. ICAT is the International Commission for the Conservation of Atlantic Tuna. Dr. Restrepo, you titled your post, A Convenient Truth. I think actually perhaps what you were referring to is a convenient mistruth or a convenient falsehood. But I know you were playing on the famous Al Gore Inconvenient Truth film. You asked the question, why is the 90% figure still being used? And I wondered, since this has been so clearly demonstrated, not only by your student, Dr. Juan Horda, but also by the immediate reaction of so many qualified scientists who study tuna, why, in your estimation, does this 90% figure continue to be an urban legend, I guess?
I guess it's part of human nature. Sometimes bad news sell better than good news. And so for many reasons, this number is still a simplistic number that some people or some groups hang on to. In some cases, for example, if people want to get funding for research or conservation projects related to tunas, it's easier to sell as an argument, well, we need this money for conservation focused on tunas because 90% of the tunas are gone and we must do something about it. So it's an exaggeration of the depletion that sells a little bit better than if you said, well, actually, tuna populations are at about the level where we want them to be. Then there would be no campaigns and no fundraising done for those efforts. But don't take me wrong. All tunas need to be managed. All tuna fisheries need to be managed, but they need to be managed in a rational way, one by one. They're all different. All tuna fisheries are different. They target different populations. The conditions are different in the different oceans. So we need to do the research and the management focused on each fishery and each population. But we must stay away from these simplistic arguments, such as 90% of the tunas are gone for fundraising, because that just derails all of the efforts that are being made by the tuna regional fishery management organizations and by national governments to manage tunas rationally.
Dr. Restrepo, we always hear from fishermen and frequently from fisheries scientists alike, the need for more funding and better science, and a frustration with so many stock assessments, especially the ones in the Northeast that have repeatedly been far off, predicted that things are coming back like cod and then they're not, or predicted that they're in bad shape like pollock and then they turn out to be in better shape. You mentioned specifically that you wish some of these groups would stop using this 90% figure because it's diverting attention from some of the real issues. You specifically mentioned the need to adopt stock-specific reference points and to improve decision-making. Can you tell us a little bit about, can you expand on that a little bit? What are stock-specific reference points and what needs to be done to make these assessments better?
Well, in any endeavor that we take in any kind of industry, it's very useful to have very clearly stated objectives and benchmarks, things that you want to achieve in a given year, a given output that you want to achieve. And so reference points are exactly that for fish populations. You want to establish what is your target, where you want the stock to be, let's say, next year or 5 years from now or 10 years from now. And you also want to establish limits, places where you don't want the stock to go. So if you establish both targets and limits, and then mechanism for staying away from the limits while achieving your targets on average, that's a good thing for management. And sometimes those reference points are missing in many of the tuna regional fishery management organizations. And so when those reference points and those benchmarks are missing, what happens is that each year you have endless negotiations between all of the members of the fisheries management organization with all kinds of arguments that sometimes delay conservation measures when they need to be taken. And they just put off the tough decisions until next year, and then next year they put it off again another year because they're very strenuous negotiations. And it would be a lot better if there was some pre-agreed rule for how to act, how to set quotas, for example, depending on the status of the stock, in reference to those benchmarks.
I watched a video that you did on the precautionary principle versus the precautionary approach, and wondered after watching that, maybe this is too broad of a question, but is the current system that's in place internationally through the ICAT, is it sufficiently precautionary or over-precautionary? What's your thought on that?
Oh, I think with respect to ICAT, but maybe this also applies to the other regional fishery management organizations in the other oceans, it's not a constant. Sometimes ICAT adopts management measures that are quite conservative, and sometimes it fails to do so. So I wouldn't say that it's a constant. It varies from year to year, and it varies from stock to stock. In some cases, ICAT has taken what I consider to be quite precautionary measures. In some cases, when stocks have been highly overfished, like is the case of the Eastern and Mediterranean bluefin tuna population, they have adopted pretty tough measures. Maybe they were not implemented immediately the first year that they were adopted, but you know, increasingly they put on more monitoring and control systems in place until they brought things into control. So ICAT can be quite precautionary at times, and sometimes maybe not. And this is a result, I guess, of those endless negotiations. It changes from year to year. It depends on what the members around the table want. And it would be a lot easier if they had some pre-established target that they want to achieve.
Again, thank you, Dr. Restrepo, for joining us from Miami on your vacation. I have just one last question. The different groups that have been stealing the headlines with these 90% of the tunas are gone, you know, kind of screaming headlines. If you had the ability to dictate to any of them, are there any particular groups that you would really like to see change this focus on claiming extremes that aren't true to focusing on the measures you just spoke about less crazy eternal negotiation and better reference points?
Well, I think that most groups that think about it deeply agree with me, of course. In fact, in some organizations, maybe new people that are not so familiar with the literature hang on to the simple 90% numbers because they're easier to understand. But you see more senior people who have more experience and who have read more of the literature and who know that the world is not black and white, but it's full of grays. They understand that things are more complex. You cannot just base everything you do on these simplistic figures. So I think all conservation organizations, when you talk to the more the more senior people, the more experienced people, they realize that those simplistic 90% decline figures are not right. And I'm convinced that we're all moving in the same direction. You know, sometimes some organizations are going faster, sometimes organizations are going slower. But that's our focus. That's our effort. We believe in science-based conservation measures, and this is why we put out blogs like the one that caught your interest, to try to explain to people that, you know, staying away from those simplistic numbers might actually advance fisheries management much farther.
I would have to say I agree with you, and not just in tuna. I frequently, when I see the fundraising letters and the online petitions, I wonder if they're being written by serious people or by the intern that they hired last week. So I would have to say I would agree with you on that assessment. Dr. Restrepo, thank you very much for your time and for joining us and for taking a few minutes away from your vacation. We look forward to speaking with you again in the future.
It's a pleasure. Thank you very much.
Thank you.